Welcome to this podcast, which is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'll be presenting some of the abstracts that I watched at the virtual ASCO meeting, which was held this last weekend from May 28th through June 1st. So I'd like to kick off with what I considered an exciting study, which was the CASPIAN study, and it looked at patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And it was presented by Professor Luis Paz-Eres from Madrid in Spain. Now, this was the first report of the third study arm of CASPIAN. The first two study arms had been presented previously last year. And in this particular study arm, this was an investigational CTLA-4 inhibitor called tremelimumab, which was added to the PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitor durvalumab on top of standard care chemotherapy. So the CASPIAN study, it randomized 805 patients to three different treatment arms. So the first one received etoposide, cisplatin or carboplatin as a backbone. That was 269 patients. Another group received that etoposide together with durvalumab. And the third arm received the etoposide with durvalumab and tremelimumab. And that third arm is what was reported today. So the primary endpoint of the study was overall survival, and it had to be significant before they were going to do extensive PFS analysis. They were going to have a significant overall survival statistic for the two arms with immunotherapy, so both with just the anti-PD-1 like, which was reported last year and was significant, and the one that was presented this last at the ASCO this year, which was including the tremelimumab data. So findings from the CASPIAN previously reported that after a medium follow-up of 14.2 months, the addition of durvalumab on top of the etoposide did improve the median overall survival to 13 months versus 10.3 months. And that was a highly significant number with a hazard ratio of 0.73. So consequently, the FDA actually in March 2020 this year, they approved durvalumab in combination with etoposide as the first-line therapy for ES-SCLC. So in the current presentation, after a medium follow-up of 25.1 months, so over 2 years, the medium overall survival was to 12.9 months among patients who received durvalumab with etoposide, compared to 10.5 months for those who had received EP alone, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.75. Highly significant. So it fully supported that initial report last year. So of note, for this particular study, the study design did allow either the use of a backbone carboplatin or cisplatin, and the OS data really favored durvalumab no matter what the backbone was. So with carboplatin or cisplatin, in both cases, it was significant. So importantly, the separation among the curves really does seem to be observed over time, and indeed survival at 2 years improves from 14% of the participants in the control arm to 22% on the experimental arm. So the magnitude of this benefit is very similar and very consistent across all the pre-specified subgroups of the patients analyzed, including those treated with cisplatin and those with liver or brain metastases. However, the study's third arm, including tremelimumab, did not meet the pre-specified threshold for statistical significance. And the median overall survival of this combination was 10.4 months, which was really the same as the 10.5 months for the etoposide alone arm. And that was a hazard ratio of 0.82, but it was not significant. The OS survival rates at 18 months were 32% for the durvalumab plus the etoposide, at 30.7% in the tremelimumab plus durvalumab plus the etoposide group, and in 24.8% in the etoposide cohort alone. And at 24 months, those rates were 22%, 23%, and 14% respectively for those groups. So the median PFS was 4.9 months for the tremelimumab and durvalumab and etoposide arm, which was compared to 5.4 months for the etoposide month alone, group alone. And that had a hazard ratio of 0.84. So I think the safety events, they were consistent with pretty much all the known adverse events associated with these medicines. There were the rates of grade 3, 4, and other and more serious adverse events were high at 70.3% for the tremelimumab and durvalumab and etoposide arm, whereas it was 62.3% for the durvalumab plus etoposide arm, and about the same for the etoposide alone group. So it seems like all in all, the benefit to ratio, risk ratio really did favor the treatment with durvalumab, with the etoposide without tremelimumab for the treatment of treatment-naive ES-SCLC in the first line. Over to breast cancer, the results from the long-awaited E2108 trial was reported by Professor Seema Hassan Khan from the Feinberg School of Medicine in the U.S., and this was the final follow-up data presentation with a median follow-up of 59 months. There's actually been a paucity of data about whether surgery and radiation to breast tumors, so local therapies, can prolong overall survival compared with systemic treatment alone. And the goal of E2108 was to determine whether surgery and radiation should become routine practice for patients with stage 4 breast cancer. So in total, 390 women with stage 4 breast cancer were enrolled, and they received the optimal systemic treatment based on their tumor biomarker status and their specific metastatic profile. Of those whose disease responded to the initial systemic therapy, 256 women were randomized to either receive continued systemic therapy or to receive surgery and radiation prior to continuing systemic therapy. With 5 years follow-up, it was evident that there was absolutely no overall survival advantage for the local therapy versus systemic therapy alone. And that was 68.4% versus 67.9% with a hazard ratio of 1.09 and a very insignificant p-value of 0.63. Furthermore, local regional therapy did not improve 3-year progression-free survival, and that was also a p-value of 0.4. So, however, in favor of local therapy, recurrence or progression was significantly higher in the systemic arm alone at 25.6% versus 10.2% with a p-value of 0.003. Patient-reported quality of life, however, as measured by the FACT-B trial outcome index to score depression, anxiety, and well-being, did not show any advantage for the local regional therapy arm at the trial, which was a surprising result. Professor Khan compared the results to another trial, which was done a couple years ago in Mumbai, and they showed very, very similar results, and the trial also had a very similar study design to E218. So it's encouraging to see that these results were completely reproduced in a different trial conclusion. So Professor Khan concluded that based on the results of their study, women who present with a new diagnosis of breast cancer already in stage 4 should not be offered surgery and radiation for the primary breast tumor with the expectation of a survival benefit. So it was an interesting talk. Now to talk a bit about melanoma. There was an interesting story, the ERTC 1325/KEYNOTE-054-54 trial. That was a phase 3 trial, and it was presented by Professor Alexander Egermont from the Princess Máxima Center for Pediatric Oncology in the Netherlands. So the purpose of this study was to assess whether post-surgery therapy with pembrolizumab improves disease recurrence for high-risk participants with melanoma, so in stage 3A, 3B, and 3C, as compared with the placebo arm. So this is 3-year follow-up data. It included this trial, the KEYNOTE-54 ERTC 1325. It included 1,019 adults with stage 3A, 3B, or 3C, resected melanoma metastatic to lymph nodes. Patients were assigned to either adjuvant pembrolizumab at 200 milligrams every 3 weeks for up to a year, and that was 514 patients, or the placebo arm, and that was 505 patients, for a total of 18 doses until disease recurrence or unacceptable toxicity. The co-primary endpoints were recurrence-free survival in the intent-to-treat population as a whole, but also in patients with PD-1-like positive tumors in the pre-specified subgroup analysis. So previously, with the median follow-up of 1.25 years, the investigator had reported improved recurrence-free survival for pembrolizumab compared with placebo with a hazard ratio of 0.57. In the current presentation, results with a median follow-up of 3.05 years again showed superior recurrence-free survival for the pembrolizumab arm compared with the placebo arm, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.56, so very similar to the data 2 years earlier. Among patients with a PD-L1 positive tumors, a 3-year recurrence-free survival rate with pembro was also better than placebo, with a hazard ratio of 0.57 and a p-value that was highly significant. Pembrolizumab was also better for the RFS of patients with BRAF-mutated tumors and patients with BRAF wild-type tumors, and those were all significant results. So in conclusion, adjuvant pembro confirmed a durable, clinically meaningful RFS benefit for patients with resected high-risk stage 3 melanoma. So urothelial cancer is next on my list, and there was an exciting study, the Javelin Bladder 100 study, which was presented by Professor Thomas Powles from the Barts Cancer Institute in the UK, and they looked at how avelumab works as maintenance therapy for urothelial cancer for bladder cancer. So first-line platinum-based chemotherapy for advanced bladder cancer, it's characterized by frequent resistance, and PD-L1 and PD-1 inhibitors such as avelumab are standard second-line treatment for patients with disease progression. However, only a minority of patients obtain a durable clinical benefit. So the Javelin Bladder 100 trial investigated avelumab as the first-line maintenance therapy in patients whose disease had not progressed with first-line platinum-based induction chemotherapy. There were 700 participants who underwent 4 to 6 cycles of standard platinum-based chemotherapy, so cisplatin with gemcitabine or carboplatin with gemcitabine, followed by a treatment-free interval between 4 to 10 weeks. Then 350 patients were randomized to receive avelumab at 10 milligrams per kilogram by IV every 2 weeks, and best supportive care, which was typically antibiotics, nutrition, hydration, pain management, while the other 350 patients received best supportive care alone. Co-primary endpoints of this study were overall survival in all of the randomized patients or the PD-1-like positive population. Secondary endpoints were progression-free survival, objective response rate using RECIST 1.1, safety and tolerability, and patient-reported outcomes. So the primary endpoints were both met. The median overall survival for the avelumab and best supportive care arm was 21.4 months versus 14.3 months for the best supportive care alone in the overall population, and that was at a hazard ratio of 0.69, highly significant number. And it was better in the PD-1-like patients as well, and that was with a hazard ratio of 0.56. However, Professor Powles pointed out that the patients who had PD-1-like negative or unknown status also showed benefit, and that all the pre-specified subgroup analysis broadly favored the avelumab group. The secondary progression-free survival endpoint was also significant. In the avelumab plus best supportive care arm, progression-free survival was 3.7 months as compared with 2 months for the best supportive care alone, with a hazard ratio of 0.62. So the safety profile of avelumab as first-line maintenance was manageable and consistent with previous studies of avelumab monotherapy. So in conclusion, this late-breaker abstract really highlighted the statistically significant improvement in overall survival observed with the combination of PD-1-like inhibitor avelumab plus best supportive care versus best supportive care alone in patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma following platinum-based chemotherapy in the frontline setting. Based on the Javelin Bladder 100 findings, the FDA has granted a breakthrough therapy designation to avelumab in this setting. Professor Powles closed his presentation by stating that, quote, "Overall, avelumab first-line maintenance in patients whose disease has not progressed with platinum-based induction therapy is a new first-line standard of care in advanced urothelial cancer," end quote. Jumping over to metastatic colorectal cancer, I'd like to talk about the KEYNOTE-177 trial results, which were presented by Professor Thierry André from the Saint-Antoine Hospital in Paris, France. So this was the first phase 3 study of pembrolizumab versus standard of care, which is chemotherapy plus bevacizumab or cetuximab. And it looked at really first-line pembrolizumab in patients with high microsatellite instability metastatic colorectal cancer. So about 5% of all metastatic colorectal cancers are characterized by microsatellite instability, and it's often linked with germline mutations and Lynch syndrome. Mismatch repair status and microsatellite instability predict clinical benefit of immune checkpoint blockade with pembrolizumab as first-line therapy for microsatellite high metastatic colorectal cancer, and it's been FDA approved for adults and children with metastatic tumors of any tumor type with microsatellite instability. So previously, the KEYNOTE-164 study evaluated the anti-tumor activity of pembro as previously treated metastatic microsatellite instability high mismatch repair deficient colorectal cancer. And in the current study, it was used for treatment-naive microsatellite instability patients who were treated with first-line pembro. So this KEYNOTE-177 study, it took 307 stage 4 treatment-naive colorectal cancer patients with confirmed microsatellite instability or mismatch repair deficiency, and the patients had to have good performance status. So patients were randomized to either pembro, that's 153 patients, and they received 200 milligrams every 3 weeks for up to 35 cycles, or investigator choice of therapy, and that was 154 patients. Most of the patients received FOLFOX6 or FOLFIRI-based, plus bevacizumab or cetuximab. There was an optional crossover to the pembrolizumab regimen for patients with centrally verified disease progression by RECIST version 1.1. The dual primary endpoints were progression-free survival per RECIST by blinded independent central review and overall survival. Secondary endpoints were the overall response rate and safety. Tumor response was assessed at week 9 and every 9 weeks thereafter by RECIST by the central committee. With a median follow-up of 32.4 months, pembrolizumab was superior to chemotherapy in terms of progression-free survival, 16 and a half months in the pembro group versus 8.2 months in the chemotherapy control arm, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.6. Overall survival data are still immature. The overall response rate was 43.8% in the pembro arm as compared to 33.1% in the chemotherapy control arm, and that was a significant p-value. The median duration of response was not reached by the pembro group, but it was 10.6 months in the chemotherapy arm. So treatment RECIST-related adverse events of grade 3 or higher reported in 22% of the patients in the pembro arm as opposed to 66% of the patients in the chemo arm. So no new toxicities with pembrolizumab were observed. So in short, the pembro really provided a clinically meaningful and statistically significant improvement in PFS versus chemotherapy in patients with microsatellite instability or mismatch repair deficient metastatic colorectal cancer. Responses were also more durable with pembro, and furthermore, there was an improved safety profile with pembro versus chemotherapy. Professor Andre concluded that the pembrolizumab should be considered as the new standard of care in, as first-line therapy in patients with microsatellite unstable metastatic colorectal cancer. I'm going to close with another lung cancer story. I thought this was a really exciting trial, the Phase 3 ADORA trial. It was presented by Professor Roy Herbst from the Yale Cancer Center in the U.S. So this is a non-small cell lung cancer, and it looked at adjuvant osimertinib, and this trial really did shake up the world, I think, a bit. So osimertinib, it's a third-generation epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor with demonstrated efficacy as a frontline agent for metastatic non-small cell lung carcinoma with confirmed EGFR mutation status. So the Phase 3 ADORA clinical trial, it attempted to assess whether this agent is also effective in earlier stages of metastatic disease characterized by EGFR mutation, namely as an adjuvant therapy after complete surgical resection of stage 1B, 2, or 3A disease. So oral osimertinib was given at 80 milligrams once daily. It was compared to placebo for a treatment duration of up to 3 years or until disease recurrence. The primary endpoint was disease-free survival, and the key secondary endpoint was overall survival. Other secondary endpoints included disease-free survival at 2, 3, and 5 years, patient-related quality of life, and plasma concentrations. The study was unblinded early after the recommendation from an independent data monitoring committee due to efficacy, and it was an unplanned interim analysis that Professor Herbst described. At the time of unblinding, all the patients had been enrolled and randomized, and there were 682 patients, and all the patients had been followed up for at least a year. So for the primary endpoint in stage 2 to 3 patients, the disease-free survival curve separated early on and showed an 83% reduced risk of disease recurrence for the osimertinib arm, with a hazard ratio of 0.17. If you add in the earlier stage patients, the stage 1B patients, to the overall population, it did not change the data, with the hazard ratio still being 0.21. So it indicated that osimertinib really benefits early stage patients as well, stage 1B. Disease-free survival across all subgroups in the overall population was a favored osimertinib, and that included age, gender, smoking status, Asian versus non-Asian, EGFR mutation, and adjuvant chemotherapy. So the median duration of exposure was 22.3 months, and that was a range from 0 to 43 months. For the osimertinib arm, and 8.4 months for the placebo arm. Osimertinib was well tolerated with a safety profile consistent with its known safety trial profile of diarrhea, dry skin, pruritus, and there were no adverse events leading to death in the osimertinib arm. The rate of grade 3 to 4 adverse events was low. Interstitial lung disease, always a concern with Asian patients, was reported in about 3% of the patients in the osimertinib arm, but in none of the patients in the placebo group. However, cardiac QTc prolongation was reported in 22 patients, which is 7% in the osimertinib arm and 4 patients in the placebo arm. So in conclusion, adjuvant osimertinib is the first targeted agent in a global randomized trial to show significant and clinically meaningful improvement in disease-free survival in patients with stage 1B to 3A EGFR mutant non-small cell lung carcinoma. Overall, there was a 79% reduction in the risk of disease recurrence or death with osimertinib. Osimertinib versus placebo disease-free survival rates at 2 years was 89% versus 53%, respectively. A consistent improvement was observed in disease-free survival, regardless of prior adjuvant chemotherapy. The safety profile seemed really beneficial, and in short, adjuvant osimertinib really provides a highly effective, practice-changing treatment for patients with stage 1B to 3A EGFR mutant non-small cell carcinoma after complete tumor resection. Thank you for listening to this podcast.